Welcome to the Bill Barnwell Show. I'm Bill Barnwell, ESPN. We are here. It's Friday. It's not Thursday. It's Friday, December 28th, 2018. We had to do the show a day late this week. I was traveling back from Texas where I spent Christmas. Happy holidays. Merry Christmas to those of you who celebrate Christmas. Of course, it's a very busy time of the NFL year, even though we are in the midst of the holiday season. Week 17 is upon us, the final week of the NFL season. I can't believe it is actually the end of the regular season. A fascinating year in so many ways, and one of the most fascinating teams in the NFL this year, a team that is coming off of a Super Bowl victory, that has had a very up and down, very strange season in so many ways, ending with apparently Nick Foles proving he's better than Carson Wentz, a thing I did not expect to see at any point during the season, is the Philadelphia Eagles. And joining us to talk about that is our Eagles contributor on the show. He covers the Eagles for The Athletic, does wonderful work for their Philadelphia site. It's Mr. Shel Kapadia. Shel, how are you?
What's up, Bill? How you doing?
I'm good. We're going to get to the Giants later with Mr. Alan Sepinwall. But first, let's talk about the Eagles here. And let's talk about Nick Foles and Carson Wentz. That is strangely, I don't know how much of this is a real thing versus a joke thing versus a troll thing on the internet, but just from your perspective, as someone who covers this team every day, as someone who interacts with Eagles fans every single day, do you think there is a meaningful portion of Eagles fandom that actually believes Nick Foles is better than Carson Wentz?
I don't think so. I think it's probably a vocal minority. You know, I think it's, when you come down to it, the fact is that the way Nick Foles has played the last 2 weeks has been pretty amazing, and the offense has looked better with him the last 2 weeks than it has for most of the season with Carson Wentz. So that's like point A. And then point B is Carson Wentz is overall the better quarterback. Carson Wentz will give the team a better chance to win going forward. There's no quarterback controversy for 2019 and beyond. And so, like, those are two separate points, and I think some have had sort of a hard time you know, acknowledging that both those things can be true, which they are. But, you know, it's tough because I think Foles has such a special place in the city right now for that Super Bowl run last year. And then it looks like the season's going down the tubes and they go to Los Angeles as 13.5-point favorites and he plays well. And then they beat the Texans at home and now they have some life. So it's like this is the first time really all season the past week or two where it's felt like the 2017 Eagles.
Yeah, I mean, it's really been intriguing to me because earlier in the year, it's not as if Foles was playing at a high level in week one and week two. He really struggled against the Falcons, posted a 50.7 passer rating, and then against the Bucks, you know, the numbers were fine, 334 and a touchdown, but I don't remember him playing at an especially high level. You know, it kind of felt like, oh, we were excited to get Carson Wentz back, you know, even though Nick Foles is, he's fine, but, you know, Carson Wentz is going to be an upgrade on Nick Foles, and we don't have any doubt about that. And I mean, over the last 2 weeks, again, the numbers against the Rams weren't necessarily great, but they pull out that football game, and then he was excellent, I thought, last week against the Texans. What do you think has changed in terms of this offense to, you know, sort of give Nick Foles the platform to succeed over the last couple of weeks?
Yeah, you're right overall. I mean, if you look at the season, you know, Nick Foles is averaging 6.9 yards per drop back. Carson Wentz is at 6.6. It's actually very similar if you do include those first two games of the season. I mean, I think what's changed the last 2 weeks, it's a few things. I think number one, and we can say this pretty definitively, is that Nick Foles takes a lot fewer sacks than Carson Wentz. If you just look at kind of their sack percentage, even going back to last year, Foles is someone who doesn't think he's a great athlete. He doesn't think he's Aaron Rodgers or Russell Wilson. So he doesn't, you know, hold the ball and extend plays and try to avoid sacks and get out of the pocket. Like, you know, he's done that a little bit. I thought he did that a little bit in the postseason last year, but it's uncharacteristic of him. So avoiding those negative plays and those sacks has really, I think, helped the offense quite a bit. I mean, he's only been sacked, I think, on 1.2% of his dropbacks in the last 2 weeks. And, you know, Wentz was at 7.2% for the entire season. So that's been one major difference. And then Foles has been great throwing the ball downfield the last 2 weeks. Now, it's a small sample size. He's thrown it 8 times, but he's connected on 6 of them. And that's just been an element of the passing game that had been missing for most of the season. It just felt like the offense had to work so hard for any time they wanted to put points on the board. It came via like a 6, 7, 8, 9 play drive. And with Foles, they've been able to get some of that quick strike offense back. You know, he had the 83-yard touchdown to Nelson Agholor last week. I think that's just the fourth time all season they've had a passing touchdown outside of the red zone. Like, those big play touchdowns have just been completely missing. Yeah, I think they were last in the NFL going into last week, or certainly going into the previous week in that category. So I think those two things have probably been the biggest difference. And then the last one is he's getting rid of the ball quicker than he ever has at any point in his career. You know, he hasn't been someone who was just really good at that sort of quick game, catch the ball out of shotgun, you know, get it to your playmakers and really negate the pass rush. But the last 2 weeks, he has done that. So I think it's a credit to the coaching staff. It's a credit to him. And there's no denying, you know, he's averaging 9.3 yards per attempt over the last 2 weeks and completing 74% of his passes. So, like, it's not fluky. He has been playing sort of at this very high level that the Eagles had not seen from their quarterback all season long.
Yeah, I think absolutely. You can just see it. He just seems very confident back there in a way that, you know, he wasn't really even earlier in the season. And I don't know, you know, necessarily internally why he might feel that way, but it seems like he's being put in situations where he can succeed. And in terms of this offense, in terms of what Doug Peterson has been doing, I mean, have there been changes to how they've used their personnel or changes into the sort of, you know, the sort of plays they've been running or the routes they've been running to sort of make things easier for Foles?
Yeah, there have. And I think also from sort of the coaching staff's perspective, you know, Carson Wentz is a, and this isn't a negative, but he's like a demanding, he sort of has that personality that he wants to be in control. He meets with Doug Peterson about the game plan every week. He's suggesting changes. Like, that's his personality, and it's served him very well, you know, both in college and in the NFL. Like, he's sort of, he's obsessed with that kind of stuff and really thinks he can be a big help in terms of adjustments and the game plan. And Nick Foles is just different. He's like, you know, I know he recommended the Philly special in the Super Bowl, but that was sort of, you know, a little bit the exception. He's more like, give me the plays, I'll run them. You know, he's very laid back. He's not sort of as demanding. So I think that's probably been a little bit easier for the coaching staff in one respect, where it's just like they're coming up with the game plan, you know, and they have to worry kind of less about fit and that kind of thing with Foles, maybe, than the opinion of Wentz. And in terms of how they're using guys, they've really moved to a lot of 12 personnel and even 13 personnel, multiple tight end sets the last 2 weeks. You know, the first, I think it was first 14 games of the season, they were in 11 personnel, I think 55-60% of the time with the three wide receivers. And in the last 2 weeks, that's down to like 44%. So, I think it took them too long. I think the last time I was on with you, you know, we were probably talking about maybe they should use Dallas Goedert a little bit more with Zach Ertz, because they just have so many guys who do the same thing with Golden Tate and Nelson Agholor and Ertz. And it's just like all these guys who sort of work the middle of the field in the intermediate part. And so it just made sense for them to avoid some of that duplication, that repetitiveness, and go to more 12 personnel. So they made the trade for Golden Tate, you know, middle of the season, and he hasn't really been a big factor. They've leaned more on the rookie tight end, Dallas Goedert, who has played well. Zach Ertz is obviously having a great season. And so those have been some of the major differences. And then, you know, they've simplified things. And I'm always sort of hesitant to give credit when a coach says, like, oh, you know, we're going to simplify things. It seems like something they say whenever things aren't going well. But you can see it when you watch the games. You know, they've really taken out a lot of the shifts and the pre-snap motions. That's helped Foles. And then they just go back to the same plays that he likes over and over again. I know we talked about that mesh concept the last time I was on with you. I mean, they're running that like five times a game with Nick Foles. It's his favorite play. He knows exactly how to read it. He knows where to go with the football. And so they have done a good job of going to kind of his comfort plays, just like they did last year in the postseason.
Yeah, I mean, Nick Foles, an air raid quarterback in college, certainly familiar with mesh, you know, going back to then, and of course ran a version of it for a lot of, you know, I'm assuming a good chunk of yardage, a fair amount of the time, with Chip Kelly during Chip Kelly's time in Philadelphia. And in terms of the Golden Tate trade, I mean, obviously, I think with the benefit of hindsight, you would go back and say, okay, well, the Eagles made a bad trade. And I don't think it's going to hurt them that much, because I think they will get a comp pick. I don't see them spending a ton in free agency this year. So even if, you know, you traded a mid-round pick, you're going to get a lesser pick back, but it was a rental. And I don't think at the end of the day, it was a terrible, you know, franchise altering decision. But do you think we were maybe a little too aggressive at the moment before we knew what was going to happen, just because he played in the slot and there were so many Eagles receivers who wanted to work out of the slot and work the intermediate routes of the field?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. And, you know, to be perfectly honest, when they made the trade, I said it was a gamble worth taking. I thought you add another playmaker to the offense, like you said. I mean, there is some downside, but it's not a huge downside that it's going to cripple your franchise if he signs elsewhere in the offseason. You know, they're going to have to wait a year to get that pick, and they gave up a third rounder, but you do get it back in a couple of years. So I thought it was a swing worth taking. And, you know, I thought my assumption at the time was they have to have a plan. You know, if they're making a trade like this for Golden Tate, I assume that they would have a plan for Nelson Aguilar and for the tight ends and how to make sort of all the pieces work together and how to get everybody the ball. And, you know, maybe they did have a plan, but it certainly has never come to fruition. And it seems like they were sort of confused and unsure about how to incorporate Golden Tate into the offense. I mean, the first couple of weeks, they're just force feeding him the ball. And, you know, he was averaging, I think, like, I don't know, I think the quarterbacks were averaging 3-4 yards per attempt when they were throwing the football to him. The chemistry seemed totally off. So, you know, it's always tough, that sort of connect between the front office and the coaching staff. You know, maybe Doug Peterson was saying, you know, just get him for me and I can figure out a way to make it work. And, you know, it's just tough. Sometimes that does work and sometimes you had a plan and it doesn't really work out well. So I think that was really the case here with Golden Tate. And certainly if they had it to do over again, I think they would keep the third round pick for this year. But, you know, it's not going to be the end of the world for them.
Yeah, I think it's going to work out okay for them. They should have a little bit of a halo after, you know, winning the Super Bowl last year. I can't be too angry at them, but yeah, I think we're maybe, you know, I felt the exact same way as you did about the trade. It was, you know, a sound player, even if there was some, you know, there was some skill duplication and some sort of spot duplication and where he wants to play in the offense. I figured they would figure it out. They're pretty smart. They know what they're doing. And to some extent, you know, they tried, but it just didn't really fit. So I think we have to, or at least I know I have to be smarter about thinking about fit when it comes to adding a player and sort of not focus as much on the name. But I can't fault them for it. You know, it made sense to me at the time to the extent that I was willing to think that they would make it work. And they have. It just took longer and didn't involve Golden Tate. And so I think they're going to be fine when it comes to the long term in terms of their offense. I think they are, you know, they're still a smart organization. They still have a lot of people who know what they're doing. Obviously, I think the quarterback play is going to be great, even if Nick Foles does leave this offseason. All right, Shia, well, let's get to some of the changes the Eagles might make this upcoming offseason, including possibly changes with the coaching staff of the Philadelphia Eagles. And, well, if you're going to possibly go on a job interview, if you want to look your best, feel your best, possibly even smell your best, there's one place I would recommend you go to do all those things. That is going to be Dollar Shave Club. And when I say you should go, you don't have to put on pants, put on shoes, step outside into the snow, step outside into the cold, go to a store, stock up with stuff, carry it back, have the bag break. All that stuff is no fun. You don't want to do any of that. I don't want to do any of that. And I don't do that anymore because Dollar Shave Club ships me the stuff I need when I need it. It's great. I don't ever run out because they are shipping me stuff on a regular basis. I'm always fully stocked. I've always got backups. I always have what I need. I never have to go outside. I don't go on job interviews because I have a job with ESPN. But if I did go on job interviews, I'd want my breath to smell good. And, well, Dollar Shave Club's going to take care of that. They have a fantastic toothpaste. I use it every day. I use it. I'm not going to lie. I don't want to brag, but twice a day I use it. And it is fantastic. And I never run out because it's being sent to me automatically. I know that I'm always going to be good. I'm not going to have to worry about going to the store at 10 p.m. because I'm out of toothpaste. That is not ideal. Not something I want to do in the middle of a winter in New York City. And great thing is, I need it on once a month on a regular basis. If you need it once every 2 weeks, once every couple months, if you brush your teeth a little slower perhaps than I do, I guess. I don't know. Whatever you need, Dollar Shave Club can arrange that for you. They can work on your schedule to get the stuff you need to you reliably. So you don't have to go to a store. Never going to be stuck with that stuff. And right now, they've got a bunch of starter sets you can try for just $5, like their oral care kit, which includes that very toothpaste I was just mentioning. And after that, the restock box ships regularly sized products at regular price. So what are you waiting for? Get your starter set for just $5 right now at dollarshaveclub.com/barnwell. my last name, B-A-R-N-W-E-L-L. That's dollarshaveclub.com/Barnwell. Now back to the show. In terms of what you saw from this offense over the year, what do you think they do during this offseason? Do you think they go out and go bring back someone like John DeFilippo to have another mind in the room? Do you think they make an investment at a different position than they have in the past? Is there going to be a lot of turnover, or is it just kind of be running it back with the same personnel, mostly in the same spots?
Yeah, with the coaching staff, I think it would be smart still to bring somebody else in, whether it's, DeFilippo might want to go somewhere where he can call plays and right. sort of strengthen his reputation a little bit. So, who knows? Maybe they'll make a call there, but it might have to be somebody else just to, they had trouble problem solving for much of the season. When things were not going well, they couldn't sort of figure out a plan B. And, we just talked about it, the use of personnel. I mean, Dallas Goedert, he's a rookie, but when he's in there, like, the guy looks dynamic with the ball in his hands, and there's no doubt that he should have been playing more this entire season. They struggled to find ways to get Alshon Jeffrey the ball, and that's really helped with Nick Foles in there. So, yeah, I do think, I don't think there's going to be, huge firings and a huge shakeup, but I do think they'll probably make some type of addition to the offensive coaching staff. And then personnel-wise, I mean, I think there's two areas that they can really upgrade the offense pretty quickly. One is, I think they need a reliable running back. I don't think it's somebody that, you don't have to break the bank or use crazy amount of resources for, but just someone who's had some durability, who is versatile enough to play on third down, who can be a factor in the passing game and just kind of be steady in the run game. They don't need a game changer. Maybe you find somebody like that in the middle or late rounds of the draft, and that would certainly help the offense. But I think they just need more stability there, because since Jay Ajayi went down, it's just been Josh Adams and Wendell Smallwood, and then Corey Clement gets injured, and now Darren Sproles is probably going to be their leading ball carrier in week 17, and if they do get into the postseason, I would imagine he's still that guy. So that's one area. And then number two, I think they do need to add some speed on the perimeter. As we talked about earlier, they just have a lot of those intermediate type guys. I don't want to call them possession receivers, but guys who can work the middle of the field. And I think they need that vertical threat. They signed Mike Wallace to be that guy before the season. They had Torrey Smith in that role the year before. So this is something I think they know. They've sort of built this offense with a bunch of big, strong guys rather than, kind of speedy guys on the outside. So I think if they can add a vertical threat to the outside and a running back who's sort of an upgrade from what they have right now, I think the offense can be pretty good in 2019.
And those are positions where they haven't invested a lot of money. I mean, they brought in Mike Wallace for a relatively small deal. Torrey Smith was not in a big contract. Running back, of course, they have Sproles on reasonable money, but really not a position where they wanted to spend much more than $1 million or $1.5 million on a running back, preferring to go with a rotation and a bunch of draft picks as well. Do you think that changes? Do you think they go out and make those positions a priority to the extent that they do go out and pay someone like, maybe not DeSean Jackson, but just as an example, DeSean Jackson, $8 million a year to be that deep threat? Or is it just going to kind of be, we're going to take our shots, we're going to try and find a guy who is a low-cost option to fill some of those roles?
I would think it's probably going to be the latter. I think you're probably looking at sort of low-cost veterans. Now, I don't know what DeSean Jackson would take at this point in his career. That is certainly an interesting name and the type of guy they should be looking at, but I think they'll it'll be twofold. It'll be, let's get a low cost veteran and address this in the draft. I always think that's sort of the smart way to go, where if you have a rookie who comes in, you don't want to rely on a guy who you draft in like the third or fourth round to come in and play right away. But if it's at that same position and you have a veteran, you kind of protect yourself that way. And then if the rookie comes in and surprises, it's like, oh, great. Okay. He can kind of take over and he has more upside than we thought he had. So, I don't think they're going to spend a lot of money at running back and probably not at wide receiver. They have a lot of free agent decisions to make. They have to decide whether they're going to extend Carson Wentz this offseason, which suddenly has become a pretty fascinating discussion here. But, he's going to be one of the higher paid quarterbacks in the NFL whenever he does get paid. So that's a big chunk of change. So it's actually going to be, I think, a pretty eventful offseason for this team, whether they make the postseason or not. There could be a lot of turnover. They're going to have to make key decisions on guys who have been here for a while, like Jason Peters and Brandon Graham and Darren Sproles. So, there's a lot for them to do, I think, before next season.
With that in mind, I mean, do you think the Eagles should extend Carson Wentz this offseason? Obviously, I think in the long term, you know, there's a 99.5% chance that he's going to be their quarterback in 2021 on a long-term contract, but it's more a question of, you know, should we extend him after year three versus after year four? Do you think it makes more sense for them to do it earlier, or should they wait a year and sort of see how he looks and how healthy he's able to stay in 2019?
Yeah, that's the big thing, and I'm sort of on the fence. Honestly, I think if you feel like there are some durability concerns, then maybe it does make sense to just wait a year. You know, you saved some of that cap space. You can use it and make a run at the Super Bowl in 2019, maybe add some key veterans who aren't going to be around for the long term, and then kind of revisit it after next season. At the same time, the price only goes up. So, you know, guys will sign deals this off season, and then the cap will go up next off season, and it will become more expensive if you wait until, I guess, it'll be 2020 then. So, I mean, I probably would be a little bit more cautious and say, you know what's the rush? It's not going to go up a crazy amount, his price. So let's just wait a year. Let's see how he gets through 2019, protect ourselves a little bit, and then, you know, we'll be willing to kind of pay up then. I mean, if he has a monster season in 2019 and you have to make him the highest paid quarterback in the NFL, like, you know, that's not, I know Ryan Grigson would disagree, but, you know, that's not the worst problem to have, because you have that franchise quarterback who's, you know, playing out of his mind, who sort of deserves that money. So I think I would probably wait the year, but, you know, I could be convinced either way. I don't feel that strongly about it.
I was not expecting a Ryan Grigson reference to hit this show. I have to admit, I feel like you made a bet with someone where you're like, I'm going on the podcast. I bet you $100 I can mention Ryan Grigson and have it make sense in context in the 25 minutes I'm going to be on the show.
It just hit me because I'm thinking like, all right, this is a complaint about having to pay a very good quarterback a lot of money. And then something in my brain triggered, wait, didn't someone complain about this at some point? And, you know, I don't know. My memory is usually pretty shot this time of year, but I was able to pull that. So I'm pretty proud of myself.
You should be pretty proud of yourself, my friend. So in terms of what we're going to see in Week 17, of course, the Eagles, they need some help to make it into the postseason. If they can beat Washington, which you would hope they'd be able to, this is a Washington team playing their fourth string quarterback and Josh Johnson, you know, showed a bit of life against Tennessee. Defensively did a very solid job, but before sort of crashing in the second half, and Tennessee moved the ball pretty effectively. But they need to win, and they need the Bears to beat the Vikings. Ooh, Bears beat the Vikings earlier this year. It's not out of the question, but would be a 22% chance of making the postseason per the New York Times at the moment. How important do you think it is for this Eagles team to make the postseason, given that, of course, they are coming off the Super Bowl? I mean, nobody's getting fired realistically, whether they make the playoffs or not this year, I would imagine. But do you think there is how important do you think this really is for them to make it? Because you'd figure, even if they do make it, I shouldn't say this because I know what happens when you have Nick Foles in the playoffs, but you would figure that they're probably not going to make a huge run. But I mean, I guess anything's possible. So I mean, is it important as it would have been before the Super Bowl run, you think, for them to make it into the postseason?
No, I think definitely not as important as it would have been a couple of years ago. I mean, I know the fan base, and this goes for every fan base, it's just fun to have that playoff game on that first weekend and extend your season a little bit. And, you know, it is a little bit wide open this year, it feels like, at least. I don't know if the numbers back that up, but just sort of anecdotally, you know, they went to Los Angeles and beat the Rams, and they did that last year too. So, you know, I'm not saying they would have another Super Bowl run in them, but, you know, who knows, maybe you can pull off an upset and see what happens. But there is kind of the flip side to that too. You know, the bottom line is they've been a very mediocre team for most of the season, and they've had a lot of issues. And so if you finish strong and you make the playoffs, does that mask some of those issues? Do you approach the offseason differently? Do you say, you know what, we don't need to make any changes to the coaching staff. We don't need new ideas. We just needed to get healthy and, you know, kind of find our footing in the second half of the season. Like, that to me would be a problem and would be a mistake, because you have to look at the big picture. And the bottom line is they've underachieved for a lot of the year coming off that Super Bowl win. So there are kind of two sides to it. I mean, people will be angry, and they will, you know, they've been getting criticized all year as it is, and they will get criticized if they fail to make the postseason this year. But in the sort of bigger picture, the grand scheme of things, you're right. It's probably not that big of a deal.
Is there a scenario where you think they could match up well against some of the teams in this postseason? Like, if they're going into the NFC as the sixth seed, who do you think they want to see the rest of the way heading to the Super Bowl?
I would think they wouldn't mind playing the Rams again. I mean, it's been 2 years in a row where they've been able to score a lot of points against that defense. I know that defense isn't really as good this year, and you know, they put up 30 plus on the road against them 2 years in a row. So I think that's probably the team they would like to face. They were able to get after Jared Goff quite a bit. He didn't play very well in that game, so that's number one. And then you know, they probably don't. The Bears is a tough one, you know, because it's like going up against their defense. Would Nick Foles and company be able to go to Chicago and put points on the board? I mean, it seems like that would be far-fetched, but on the other side of the ball, you could probably get after Mitchell Trubisky quite a bit as well. So I would say that, you know, I feel like those are the two teams they could potentially face in the first round. I would say they would prefer to go to Los Angeles over Chicago, but, you know, even Chicago, I think I saw Adam Schefter tweeted out the Eagles would be like, I think it was a 5.5-point underdog, so it's not really a crazy number if they were to have to go to Soldier Field there in the first round.
Man, we saw it happen before. We know it can happen again. Nick Foles can make magic happen in the playoffs. That would be really fascinating. If Nick Foles led the Eagles to the Super Bowl again in the postseason, I think that would be a wildly entertaining offseason to come. But we will get to that in the offseason. Mr. Kapadia, you, of course, do wonderful work. Where can people check out more of your coverage on the Philadelphia Eagles?
Yeah, you can check out the podcast with me and Bo Wolf called Birds with Friends. We're going to record right after this interview is over, so you can check that out wherever you find podcasts. And then theathletic.com/Philly. I'll plug my story from today. I traveled to Zach Ertz's hometown and to Stanford to kind of write a big feature on the pretty amazing 10 months he's had with catching the game-winning touchdown in the Super Bowl and then setting the receptions record for most catches by a tight end in a season. So please do go ahead and check that out.
Please check that out. Mr. Kapadia, will you mention Ryan Grigson on this upcoming episode you're about to record of Birds with Friends?
Yeah, you know, I think I'm pretty sure Bo is not a fan of Ryan Grigson, so maybe we'll leave the show and let him vent a little bit and reference this conversation.
I can't believe that anybody would not enjoy the company of Ryan Grigson. Mr. Kapadia, it is absolutely a pleasure. You do phenomenal work. Highly recommend you go subscribe to The Athletic and go check out Shale and the rest of the writers there. But we're going to come back with more Bill Barnwell Show here in a moment. Back here on The Bill Barnwell Show, I'm Bill Barnwell of ESPN. Joining us now, someone who we had on earlier in the year to talk about the Giants. He is our professional Giants fan here on the show. But in his other life, in his slightly more important life, he is the chief TV critic for Rolling Stone. He has a new book coming out. It is called The Soprano Sessions. And right as I mentioned that, we get a bit of New York flair with random truck honking here on the show. It is Mr. Alan Sepinwall. Alan, how are you?
I'm good, Bill. I'm assuming the truck driver doesn't approve of Meadows' parallel parking skills.
I knew you were going to come up with something. I'm trying to rack my brain, like, what can I possibly tie this to? And you had it already set up. That is why you are the professional, and I am the person interviewing the professional here on the show. So, Alan, let's talk about the Giants first. We'll get to the book and the Sopranos in a little bit. But in terms of the Giants season, we talked earlier this year, things were not going great for the New York Giants at the time, it was fair to say. And you were not someone, I think, perhaps like me, who was not especially optimistic about their chances this year. But in terms of what you saw this year, can you give us sort of whether it's a grade, whether it's something you saw that you know, picked up on that was particularly positive or negative, but what have you thought about the progress the Giants have shown over the course of this season?
Well, I mean, you know, from an emotional standpoint and not being like pure analytics, you know, tank for the best possible pick you can get.
Right.
The fact that they did start to compete and play better in the second half of the year, I guess, is encouraging. Certainly the fact that Gettleman had a good draft class has been good. You know, we will, I'm sure, talk about his decision in the first round, But, you know, Barkley at least is a player. B.J. Hill is a player. Will Hernandez. So he picked up some good people there, and there's a couple of good pieces going forward. But on the other hand, you know, they're going to pick lower. It doesn't look like there's much quarterback depth in this year's class. But even if they want to get the best edge rusher, someone is going to beat them to that. So in that regard, it's the worst of all possible worlds, where Eli played just well enough that they're probably going to stick with him next year when they really need to start over.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say, it seems like that is the worst possible scenario for you. Would be not a good season, not an awful season, because that would, of course, allow you to get a high pick, but, of course, just good enough to convince the Dave Gettleman, Pat Shermer brain trust that they were correct in their read heading into the season. I mean, in terms of Eli, certainly the numbers have been up over the second half of the season. Some of his, they played an easier schedule. I think it's fair to say they played some easy teams. Of course, it's a lot easier to score 38 points on Tampa Bay than it is on some of the teams in the first half of this season. But in terms of Eli, do you buy the sort of late season improvement we've seen for him? Does it seem like he's more comfortable in that scheme than he was earlier in the year?
No, I think it's more that the offensive line has played a little bit better. Solder, in particular, has been better than he was awful in the first half. He's played better. Hernandez started out reasonably well and has gotten better, so I like him. So the left side of the line, he's getting more protection. Flowers is no longer on the team, which is nice. I'm trying to remember the name of the right guard they picked up, but you know, between that, the line overall has given him a little bit more time to throw. And the Eli defenders will always say, "Well, if he just had a good line, if he just had this, if he just had that," and there's a degree to which like everything has to be just perfect for this guy at his stage of his career to play well. But even in the games where he's playing well, he'll still throw that crushing interception like he did last week. You know, he'll still turtle up if the pass rush gets anywhere near him in a way he didn't when he was younger. I think there's definitely a sense of him protecting his body and his future in a way he didn't used to do, which I don't blame him for, but that's not what the team needs anymore. So, you know, if they can rebuild the line a little bit more, I guess he can be a decent quarterback next year, but they need to find the new quarterback, and they played Kyle Auletta for like a few series and then gave up on him.
Yeah, it does seem like that is the process with them, whether it's even the old organization where it was, hey, we're going to pretend to start Davis Webb and then we're actually not going to ever play him, and then he's going to get cut forever playing, I believe, a meaningful snap for the Giants. I mean, it makes total sense. And I think there's, you know, like you said, you can't really fault Eli for after years of playing behind horrible offensive lines for having that instinct of, oh, I don't want to get killed. Like it's not worth it for a 5-10 team to go out there and get destroyed. And I mean, I think the offensive line has played better. Timon Brown, being the guy you were mentioning, but, certainly, I think just the simple idea of, well, let's not run Eric Flowers out there week after week at tackle. It's just going to be, you're going to get a better option likely just from, you know, getting rid of your replacement level talent at certain positions and having guys who, at least even if they are not necessarily going to be your right tackle of the future or your center of the future, you know, having guys who at least are, you know, have some upside, who haven't proven that they can't play at this level so far. So it makes sense to me. And I guess I wonder, you know, in terms of what we saw from Eli, I mean, it is perhaps conspicuous that we saw that Titans game where they were able to shut down Saquon Barkley, and then with no Odell Beckham, there was not really much else the Giants could do. They threw 12 passes to Evan Engram, got 75 yards out of those. Really, it was a, you know, 21 of 44 for 229 in the pick from an offense that did nothing all day there at MetLife Stadium. I was going to say the Meadowlands, but let's give MetLife the due they deserve, apparently, and call it MetLife Stadium. So, I mean, in terms of this offseason, given that you have Eli for one more year, a $23.2 million cap hit, are you going into the offseason thinking, okay, there's no Justin Herbert, we're not getting a high draft pick, we're not getting a high enough draft pick to get whatever quarterback we might like coming through this class, probably, or are you just playing out the final year of Eli's deal and then worrying about it next year? Are you looking for a replacement in free agency and then deciding, okay, if we can get that guy, you know, we should possibly cut Eli at that point? Or is it something where you think they have to make a decision now on cutting Eli before going into the offseason, if it was your choice?
I don't know. I think they kind of, they, between the fact that they didn't take Darnold or Rosen or somebody else in this year's draft,
mm-hmm.
the fact that they didn't play Lauletta at all, other than a few series a few weeks ago,
mm-hmm.
That Herbert is not coming out, that this class is not great, and that their pick is not great to begin with,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, unless they can pick up some kind of stopgap, like if Teddy Bridgewater wants to come back to New York and start for the Giants for mm-hmm. a year or two until they have their quarterback of the future, I mean, you... It stinks, but you might as well stick with Eli at this mm-hmm. point, you know, for one more year and then draft somebody a year from now, mm-hmm. unless they fall in love with somebody in this draft. But it's a really lousy situation, and it should have been foreseen and could have been foreseen, and all of us except Dave Gettleman and Pat Shurmur foresaw it.
And ownership, to be fair. I think ownership deserves something.
Yeah, I think ownership was just so scarred by how badly McAdoo botched the benching in the mm-hmm. first place that, yeah. We could have moved on from Eli much more easily if that had been handled better a year ago.
Yeah, with five, you know, first-round quarterbacks, some of whom are playing better than others, it's fair to say. But a guy who has been impressive over the last month, I think it's fair to say, is Sam Darnold, who happens to be the quarterback of the New York Jets. Number two in total QBR since week 13. I mean, playing at a really high level with, you know, really not that much around him in terms of offensive talent. Does it hurt? I mean, do you feel, you know, does it pain you to see highlights of Darnold playing well? Or is it just,
yes.
you know, okay, well, I was going to try and give you an out, but sure, I
no,
agree.
No, I remember going into the draft, like, there was some question about Mayfield because of mm-hmm. the size and the system and the attitude and all of that. But the general consensus seemed to be, like, that the Giants really wanted Sam Darnold, and he was the quarterback they would take. And if he wasn't there, well, then maybe you can kind of justify taking Barkley, even though it still didn't really make sense for mm-hmm. reasons of positional scarcity and mm-hmm. all the stuff you've talked and written about over the years. But he was there, and they didn't take him. And he's, I mean, maybe he won't ultimately pan out, but he's playing awfully well lately. And, you know, in theory, young players improve. Eli Manning is not going to improve at this point.
No, he's not. He's not getting better. I mean, he's getting better in like the, you know, in the tiniest amount from half season to half season, but it's not like he's going to yeah. suddenly have a, you know, a 5-year run as being a top 10 NFL quarterback. And I think that has to be the frustrating thing, you know, like it's not even as if, it's as if the Giants are playing for mediocrity. Like they're sitting there and saying, okay, well, if we can just get a competent season out of Eli, if we can just get the right people around him, maybe we'll be an 8-8 team again this year. And that's just, it's so sad. Like, you know, at least, even if you're not going to tank.
This is almost blasphemous, but it's like, flags fly forever, and I wouldn't want to give up that second Super Bowl, but
right.
man, did them winning that second Super Bowl really mess up a lot about this team going forward. Because it convinced them, like, that all these things that they were not doing well could be covered over if Eli caught lightning in a bottle again.
Yeah. I mean, Jerry Reese got a few more years because of that when he had been struggling to live up to his early draft classes, certainly that first draft class, which did so well in the first Super Bowl run. Eli, you know, I mean, Eli did take a step in the right direction when they brought in McAdoo at first as OC. I thought it was the right move, and I thought he still yep. had some time left, and he was okay. It wasn't like he was not a superstar quarterback, certainly, but certainly he was not the guy he is now, which is extremely limited given the circumstances. And, I mean, it covered up a lot of flaws with the football team, and Eli, of course, is making a lot of money relative to yep. His talent level. So I'm inclined to agree with you, you know, just in terms of I think they have made mistakes to this point. I don't know that there is a significantly better solution than just running it back with Eli for one more year at this price tag, which is not as bad as it was maybe a few years ago, just given that the quarterback market has boomed so much. But do you think there is something that makes you believe they're likely to improve next year beyond this offense? I mean, do you think Odell Beckham being healthy is going to shift things around and for all 16 games as opposed to how healthy he was this year?
You assume he will be healthy for all 16 games.
True.
I love Odell,
True.
And I'm happy to have him on the team, but, you know, he does get dinged up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's certainly fair.
I mean, I feel like Gettleman's free agent signings this year did not exactly inspire me, even though Solder wound up playing better towards the end of the season.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that, like, this year he'll be able to go out and fix the offensive line, I don't know. But if he can bring in some more people, it sounds like he probably wants to draft an edge rusher, which will help the defense because mm-hmm. the defense has also not played well for the most part. You know, if Beckham's healthy, if Saquon's healthy, if the O-line holds up, they can be a mediocre team. They can maybe even challenge for one of the wild card spots or something. I mean, that, I think that's probably the best case scenario, but it's also not a great scenario because that is going to make their draft pick a year from now even worse and make it harder to take, you know, get Eli's successor.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I mean, this is a team that, again, like if they catch lightning in a bottle, like Washington the first half of the year before Alex Smith got hurt, they were probably going to make the playoffs if Alex Smith stayed healthy, and they kept a bunch of those guys. A lot of guys got hurt, but if they kept a bunch of those guys, I think they make the postseason. But realistically, it's not a, you know, not a phenomenal football team by any means. So you can catch lightning in a bottle and get lucky and have everything go your way and make the playoffs, but it just seems like it's a bad way to run a football team. I don't know. I mean, I guess we'll see.
Yeah, New York has a number of professional sports teams that seem to be chasing mediocrity in a bottom-tier playoff spot, and it doesn't tend to work out well. You want to build something sustainable, whether it's a championship or just sort of perennial playoff team, and they don't seem prepared to take their medicine to do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we should talk about him. Obviously, we've sort of hinted at it for the entirety of the segment. I know we're both people who were not super enthused about the Giants drafting Saquon Barkley so high in the first round of the NFL draft. So after year one, what are your thoughts? I mean, is it, you know, even if you don't think the money makes sense, are you excited to have him on the team? Does it just remind you of sort of the opportunities lost in terms of drafting quarterbacks? How do you feel about Saquon after year one?
I like Saquon. Saquon is fun to watch. He's very boomer bust. You know, he'll get a lot of yards on one play and then very minimal yards on the next five or six. But when he takes it, it's really quite breathtaking and exciting to watch. And, you know, it's a sunk cost. I can gnash my teeth and tear out what's left of my hair over them not taking a quarterback at that spot. But Saquon is on the team and he's good. So I'm going to enjoy him, you know, even as the rest of the team is kind of a mess, because, I mean, think how bad they would be if he was not on the team at this point.
Yeah, I mean, it really is kind of shocking. And I think that, you know, of course they would have drafted somebody. Maybe they're better if they draft Bradley Chubb or, I mean, of course, Sam Darnold. But it's tough to separate the two, because in a vacuum, Saquon Barkley is excellent. His numbers are impressive in ways and not impressive in other ways, but I don't blame him a ton for his numbers not being impressive, because, well, yeah, I mean, he could be more efficient in terms of hitting consistent plays, and I think that's fair. I don't think that's unreasonable to say. And, you know, as a rookie, he's going to keep growing. I'm not concerned that he's not going to get better as a running back in terms of his, you know, his instincts. This is a guy who was so incredibly gifted in college that he could really just, you know, break the rules and sort of destroy teams without having to, you know, be a little more patient with sort of some of the choices he makes as a runner. And, I mean, we can see he can do that sometimes at the NFL level still as well. And the receiving numbers, I mean, there's a ton of cumulative sort of yards racked up. They're not very effective when you look at it a little deeper in terms of whether it's actually improving the team. But I don't blame him for that. That's the Giants offense, where if Eli's under any pressure on third down, you know he's checking it down to Saquon and hoping that Saquon makes a couple guys miss and goes for a first down a good chunk of the time. So, you know, I think it's so tough to judge him. And I think that, you know, in a way, from Gettleman's perspective, he might sit here and say, wow, look at this guy who makes the first guy miss 90% of the time or some crazy number. He's awesome. He's so much fun to watch. I mean, he is a transcendent running back. And he might say, well, I was totally right to draft Saquon Barkley. And I'd sit here and I'd say, well, look at the Giants offense. It's still totally flawed. Even if Saquon is good, which he is, I mean, you got possibly the best, you know, you got basically the dream Saquon season for you in terms of, you know, he was healthy. He stayed effective for the majority of the year. He was, you know, had a ton of big plays, and you might not get that in the future, but, you know, overall about what you expected. But the Giants offense is not good, and it's not as if the running game is incredibly efficient. I think they're in the mid-20s in DVOA. You know, it hasn't transformed Eli as a passer. So I might sit here and say, well, my side of the argument's right too. So in a strange way, I think both sides of the Saquon debate, you know, can feel pretty confident that they were correct after year one.
And yet, here we are.
Exactly.
So I think your side of the argument is a little bit righter than Gettleman's, you know. Mm-hmm. Not to suck up to the podcast host.
Well, this isn't the Dave Gettleman show. So when you go on the Dave Gettleman show, I will not be offended, Alan, if you decide to approach things in a different way. So, well, let's get to your book on The Sopranos here in a moment. But let's talk about our pals at SeatGeek. And perhaps in the past, you would have gone to some unsavory places to buy tickets. I don't want to say who they might or might not have been affiliated with, but people were making money. It was not exactly the most legal or safe, I think it's fair to say, operation. Good news is you don't have to do that anymore. If you want to go to a big game, perhaps you want to go to a game in New Jersey, well, you don't have to go to scalpers anymore. You don't have to go to people who are using unsavory means to get you tickets. You can go on your phone. How great is that? Just go to the SeatGeek app on your phone, because when I go somewhere, when I want to get tickets to an event, I don't go to some sketchy people. I go to SeatGeek. They're my friends. They're my pals. They do great work, and they get me into events reliably and affordably. I don't have to worry about fake tickets. Don't have to worry about paying too much, because they're going to use their deal score technology to rate the tickets, so you know you are getting a great deal. And if it's not a good deal, SeatGeek will let you know. I mean, you don't have to buy tickets to a game. You can wait. SeatGeek will keep updating those records. They'll keep aggregating tickets from all over the web. They'll use their deal score technology to rate them, so you know you're getting a good deal. And then you're going to get into a game, whether it's the Giants. I don't know. I'd recommend going to the Giants in Week 17 or the Jets in Week 17. Probably more fun things you can do with your time, but baseball season's coming up. The NFL playoffs are coming up. No matter what you want to buy tickets to, you can do it on SeatGeek. And best of all, if you haven't used SeatGeek before, get $10 off your first SeatGeek purchase by downloading the SeatGeek app and entering in promo code Barnwell today. That's promo code Barnwell for $10 off your first SeatGeek purchase. SeatGeek, life's an event. We have the tickets. Now back to the show. In talking to you when we were sort of planning this, you mentioned a part from your book and one of the lengthy, I believe you have 7 new interviews with David Chase in the book?
Yeah, we did 7, I think, or 8 of them that we combined into 7 in the book. Yeah.
Okay, so you did several new interviews with David Chase, and you brought up a part of the book where you were talking to him about the infamous ending of the show, and where HBO came to him, I believe, and sort of said, you know, kind of pushed him to say, okay, well, do you think you're going to end this anytime soon? And it sort of gave Chase a time frame, at least in his head, of, okay, this is how I want to do this, and this is how long I want to keep doing this for. And it sort of gave the rest of the show, from that point forward, a sense of clarity and a sense of, you know, a sense of scope. And I don't know how you could possibly compare a show about an aging, out of touch white man in New Jersey to the Giants and this particular Giants team. But for other people, could you possibly explain why you might be making this comparison?
Well, I will say that there are definitely times when I watch Giant games where I wish that, you know, the screen suddenly cut to black. And I will also say that, you know, for an aging white guy, David Chase had a better sense of sort of when to walk away than some other people.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely fair to say. I mean, it's such a fascinating, you know, sort of thing to think about, because you mentioned you know, this is the 20-year anniversary of The Sopranos. You were writing for the New York Star-Ledger, if I believe, at the time.
Yes.
I mean, so you were, of course, uniquely positioned to talk about this show that ended up becoming, you know, such a huge part of sort of the, you know, the transition into quote-unquote peak TV, into the sort of television we were going to see over the next couple of decades. I mean, do you think it, when you think about it again, when you watch it back, I mean, are there parts of it or elements of it that hold up in a way that maybe you wouldn't have expected at the time? And are there parts that, you know, you thought might have been great in the moment that don't necessarily seem all that great now in hindsight?
I will say, for the most part, I went back to rewatch the show to write this book with Matt Zollersitz with a little bit of trepidation, because the idea is, as you said, this is like the show that created peak TV. It's the most influential, you know, scripted TV show, maybe since I Love Lucy. Just like TV in 2018 would not look the way it does without The Sopranos. And so I thought, all right, am I going to go back and am I going to watch this? And is it just going to be a collection of cliches that the rest of the business has copied over and over and over again? And it really, for the most part, played better than it did when I originally watched the run.
Really?
Because part of it is, when you're watching it the first time around, you do this thing that everybody does when they watch a serialized show, is you're trying to guess what's going to happen next, who's going to get whacked, when is this going to happen, when is that going to happen. This time I watched it again to write the recaps that fill the first half of the book, and I knew what was going to happen. And so when there was sort of an anticlimax or an unexpected thing, I was already braced for it. So to use one example, season 4, which is most people's least favorite season of the show, one of the big running arcs is Carmela is flirting with Furio, and are they going to have an affair, and is Furio going to go to war with Tony, and what's going to happen? And none of that ultimately happens. But I went in this time knowing nothing was going to happen, and then I could sort of appreciate it on both the micro level of how Edie Falco and Federico Castellucci are playing those scenes, but also this idea that when you get to the end of that season, the fact that nothing happens is supposed to be spectacularly frustrating to her, which then sets up the big fight they have in the season four finale where she kicks him out of the house. So that season at the time I found kind of annoying, you know, and that was my first one covering it regularly for the paper. And now I watch it, and not every episode's great. That season has the Columbus Day one, which is pretty terrible. But a lot of it was really good, and that held up. And the other thing that was that seemed to play better this time around was Gandolfini. And maybe that's just because he's gone, and so there's an added poignance to it that wasn't there the first time. But when the show ended, and then, you know, Mad Men and Breaking Bad and everything else followed it, you know, there became sort of this orthodoxy of, you know, here's the TV drama Mount Rushmore, and you put Gandolfini and John Hamm and Bryan Cranston and, you know, pick a fourth person and put them up there, and they're all roughly the same. No, Gandolfini is the best dramatic actor the TV has ever had, and that was more clear to me than ever when I went back to watch this. It's just, it's so incredible to see him work, you know, both with the co-stars and just in scenes where he is acting into thin air, basically. It's extraordinary.
I mean, he was incredible. And, you know, it's so, even though he had a whole other career, you know, around this one show, I find it impossible to think about him in anything else. Even though I know he's been in other stuff, I've seen him in other stuff, thought he was great in other stuff, it's impossible to think of him as anything, at least for me, besides this character. And to your point about, you know, going back the second time and watching the show from the perspective of knowing what happens, not being so concerned about what will happen next, I mean, do you think that's something you can actually do as a fan of someone who, or fan of a show that you don't know what's going to happen? So if you're watching another show for the first time, or a show that's coming out now, I mean, do you think we get sort of too concerned about knowing what's going to happen next and not focusing on sort of the emotions of the characters and sort of how they interact with one another?
I think both we as an audience and some of the people making the current TV shows get too caught up in the what happens next phenomenon, and I think it's probably hurting a lot of current shows where it's just entirely designed to be binged, and so let's have a cliffhanger here and a cliffhanger here and a cliffhanger here, and let's not worry about necessarily establishing those people. And when you go back and you watch The Sopranos, like the first half to first two-thirds of every season is not particularly serialized at all. It's just, here's a little story, you know, Tony's doing this, Tony's doing that, Carmela's flirting with Father Phil, whatever happens, and then you really get a sense of who the main characters of the show are and why they matter, so that when the plot really starts to kick in towards the end of the season, it has an impact that it doesn't in a lot of, you know, the current Netflix shows.
Yeah, I think it's absolutely fair. And of course, the most perhaps memorable part of the show, I think, for a lot of people, perhaps unfairly, I think it's fair to say, is the ending of the show, the infamous fade to black. In that interview that I mentioned, you kind of get chased offhandedly to say it was a death scene, which I thought was very, very funny, because of course, I mean, there is that, you know, I imagine the guy you mentioned who wrote the 20,000 word explanation of the proof that Tony Soprano was dead. I just imagine what he must have felt in that moment, and just the sheer satisfaction he must have had to read that, or will have to read that. But do you think the fact that Chase ended the show in that way, where it wasn't the sort of, you know, satisfying, let's wrap up, you know, let's cross all the T's ending that people were expecting, do you think that gave showrunners in the future sort of a pass to be more creative and sort of deny people easy endings? And has that been good for television, you think?
Well, I think there's been some of that, but there's also gone the other way. You know, when Breaking Bad ended, Vince Gilligan specifically talked about how he didn't want to do the Sopranos ending, even though he loved the Sopranos. It just didn't feel right for his show, and I think he was conscious of wanting to please the audience. And while I love Breaking Bad a lot, I don't think its last episode is maybe the best note it could have ended on. And I think part of that was desire to go for something neater and tidier. Some shows have been ambiguous, some haven't. But that particular moment when we were talking to Chase was really memorable, because we were not expecting to discuss the ending at all in that interview. And I just prompted him with something else, and he randomly says, you know, I had that death scene in my head for about 2 years before I wrote it. And Matt and I just looked at each other and, you know, almost telepathically communicated about whether we should follow up with him, because we were afraid he would shut down. And Matt came right out and confronted him, and Chase realized what he had said, and then we had a very long and thoughtful discussion about what exactly the phrase death scene does and doesn't mean, and what happened there. And it's, you know, it was this extraordinary thing where he explains what his motivation was for making the ending without actually explaining the ending. And, you know, maybe the guy who wrote that 20,000-word blog post is going to be thrilled, or maybe he's going to be frustrated, in part because Chase says that he never read that blog post. We'll find out.
He said he never finished that blog
post. He never
finished
it. Yes, fair enough, Bill Barnwell.
He might have gotten, like, 16,000 words in and said, ah, that guy nailed it. I'm good. Or he might have got 8 words in and said, I have so many better things to do with my life. I'm not going to read this. So perhaps that also, life imitating art. Also, we don't know whether he finished the 20,000 word thing or not. But if you are someone who is a fan of The Sopranos, if you're a fan of Alan's work, as I am, I highly recommend the book. Like you said, all those recaps of the first half of the book, and then so many interviews covering, you know, the breadth of the Sopranos series. Just a, you know, not only a great show, but just fantastic coverage of it as well. And something that I think, if you're a Sopranos fan, if you're, you know, someone who's a Sopranos fan, which I'm assuming, I think most people who listen to this show who were Grantland readers, I'm assuming you do, cannot recommend more highly that you check out this book. So, Alan, where can people buy the book? Where can people check out more of the work you do?
The book hits stores on January the 8th, which is 2 days before the 20th anniversary of the show, but it's available to be pre-ordered right now. If you pre-order and you go to the Abrams Book website before the 8th, and submit your proof of purchase, you can also get a signed book plate and a set of profane Sopranos holiday cards that you can give to somebody, you know, this time next year at a birthday or whatever. They're very funny. But it's coming out, and we're very excited about it. I think it's maybe the best thing that either of us has ever written.
Wow. It's a pretty high bar to set, but from what I've seen, absolutely agree with you. Alan, thank you so much for hopping on the show today.
Thanks, Bill. Go Giants.
All right, thanks so much to my guest today, Shel Kapadia of The Athletic, Alan Sepinwall, the chief TV critic at Rolling Stone, an NFC East-oriented show today. And I'm going to do that because I don't think we're going to talk about the NFC East a ton come the postseason short, possibly a long Cowboys run. So thanks so much for listening today, guys. We're going to I don't think we're going to have a show on Monday this year because it is going to be New Year's Eve. So you will not get to ring in the new year listening to the Bill Barnwell Show. Please have a wonderful and safe New Year's Eve, New Year's Day. Enjoy the bowl games this weekend, or enjoy the playoffs this weekend. And then we're going to come back to you next week, Thursday or Friday again. We're going to preview the wild card round of the postseason. Very exciting stuff. So thanks so much for listening. More audio coming to you next week.